Hey, Swisspreneur listeners. Every year, Swisspreneur hosts three scale-up events for its community of founders and investors. In 2024, our first get-together will be the Scale-Up Slopes in the beautiful Locks on March 1st. Join us for a day of skiing or co-working among fellow entrepreneurs and VCs, followed by a flying dinner with a mountain view and a keynote speaker from a well-known Swiss scale-up. The event is open to all entrepreneurs interested in learning about the scale-up journey. Click the link in the show notes and apply to join before January 30th to get an early bird discount. We hope to see you there.
As soon as it was over, I was incredibly emotional. So I remember that was maybe the day after I left, and I just went into the office to pack my things, and I just started crying. And that's something that not many people know.
Welcome to the Swisspreneur Show, a podcast about startup stories and learnings from experienced entrepreneurs. Here's your host, Sylvan.
Nicholas, a very welcome to the Swisspreneur Show. It's great to see a familiar face here on the other side of the table.
So nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
You did a lot. You are the co-founder of Points, a B2B2C platform for SMEs. And you also founded APSI, a mental health platform for online or in-person sessions with psychologists. So you're an entrepreneur through and through. Before we talk about your ventures, you're actually on your way to become a professional footballer. And then you worked in finance. So footballer turned banker for 5 years. Before you get getting your bachelor's in general management. So I was wondering, why did you decide to go back to school? Why was that necessary for you?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question. Yeah, from footballer to banker. I even stopped quickly at a hedge fund, actually. So I was a footballer, banker, then in a hedge fund, and then back to school. That's a weird journey. there was a gap in between, actually, because I had a plot switch in my life. When I was about 20, 21, when I was working at the small hedge fund in Zug, I was trading derivatives and realized that the markets that I thought would be very interesting, so the stock market, that they're actually not really the thing that would be my main purpose and that could maybe also make me happy in a career. So I actually decided to leave Switzerland completely. And I paid my taxes, left my flat, and I went to Asia. Started in Nepal, and I told everyone I'm not coming back. I stay in Asia now. And then when I came back, it was right before when I talked to a guy in Bangkok, actually in an evening with a lot of beer. And he's an entrepreneur. And I told him, like, hey, I think I want to go back to Switzerland and be an entrepreneur. And then he told me, you know what? If I could go back in life, I would do one thing different. I would study, because when you're young, you meet a lot of people that think like-minded and are passionate about a topic. That's a beautiful thing to do. And then on my way back home in the flight, I thought about that sentence, like, that's interesting, because I was always passionate about business and entrepreneurship since I'm 14. So why wouldn't I want to study this with other people? So that was actually my goal. I really wanted to go back and be with other people thinking about business and entrepreneurship. That was the reason why, actually.
Well, so that was a very impactful trip to Asia then. It shaped your life direction.
Yeah, it does. Maybe we talk a bit later about meditation as well, because this was also the first time I visited a monastery in Thailand and stayed there for a while and meditated and got in touch with that whole mindfulness movement or religion in Thailand. So that was really interesting and impactful. Yes,
amazing. And then you really did switch to the entrepreneurial side as well, right? You co-founded Chebu. You were a late co-founder there. You started your next venture, Points. And you know, staying with the topic of education, did you feel that a bachelor's degree was necessary to become an entrepreneur and to really start your ventures?
The short answer is no. I don't think that the bachelor is necessary to be an entrepreneur. I don't think so. In my case, it was funny that Cetave, so the University of Applied Science that I went to, was crucial nonetheless that I did the first thing, because I met at the info day of the university, I met Daniel Abebe, which is now the owner of Huggy Studio. And actually, he was the guy that founded Chebu and invested a lot of money in the first prototype. And then he asked me to be the co-founder. So I actually did the first thing because of Zettawe, because I met Donnie there. Yeah. So that was my connection. The Bachelor itself, I don't think so. Maybe to prove myself that if I would want to, I could also go like a path or a career that is more school oriented as well. Maybe there was something like that I needed to prove it to myself that it's possible. That's maybe one reason why it was interesting to do.
But if I understand that correctly, you say it's not necessary content wise to become an entrepreneur, but like university schools are a great breeding ground to find your potential co-founders.
I think that's actually true. Yes, because I think it's an interesting moment in life. You're like, I don't know, in your 20s,
right?
And everything is possible. Right. And maybe also the frustration that you have in school sometimes helps you, you know, like there is something to it, because you sit there in these classes and you talk about interesting case studies, but there is something within you when you're an entrepreneur to go like, but then I want to do it, you know,
sure.
And then you see other people thinking likewise. And then you actually go forward doing it. And for me, it was maybe the thing that I did it at the same time. So I built points next to my bachelor's. And that was a very interesting combination, because I actually had things that were going on in the office. And then in the evening, I went to school. And that was interesting as a combination, yeah. I have to say.
I like that a lot. Before, you said you started becoming interested in entrepreneurship when you were 14 years old. So I'm wondering, where does your entrepreneurial drive come from? Did you have any role models or family members who inspired you that, hey, entrepreneurship is actually a possible career path for you?
Interesting. I actually, yeah, my dad was kind of an entrepreneur, meaning that he did small things, but he wasn't really inspiring me to become an entrepreneur. I think what it maybe was is thinking contrarian, thinking different, not accepting the status quo or a boss. I think I have a lot of issues with hierarchies, structural hierarchies. And that's something that is maybe that entrepreneurs some share, that you actually want to do something on your own. And I think this whole thing of thinking different and trying to change something in your world to prove that, I think that is a drive. That is a drive that pushes you forward. Yeah. And the other thing is maybe also a bit fear, you know, because when you start, after starting, I also feel that fear in the most positive way that you can think of it also acts kind of as a coal that makes the train roll, you know. So there is something that you don't want to fail. You don't want to fail your team. You don't want to fail yourself or your vision and the investors. And that's something that pushes you forward too. So I think it's kind of hope and changing something and fear that brings that nice energy forward.
A combination of a lot of different feelings and motivation behind that.
Yeah, exactly.
Many people have seen points, you know, as billboard ads or have even used points themselves. I think it's a very well-known startup here in Switzerland. You joined in 2013 as a late co-founder. You were then part of that founding team for 6 years. Can you take us back to these early days? How did you get started with points? How did you get involved with the company?
Yeah, very funny story. I was actually with Donnie doing the J-Boo thing for maybe like half a year, 8 months. And we did it, I think, also because we really wanted to be entrepreneurs, which is not per se a good drive. I think it's not per se a good idea. But we were like 22, 23. The startup world in Zurich and Switzerland was much, much smaller than today. And then I needed a job because I came back from Asia with no money on my bank account. So I needed money. And then Points was actually already like founded like 3-4 months before. And then they started to look for a sales guy. And I was like, hey, that's a cool combo. I can build the startup, join a startup, learn from it, be a sales guy there and study at the same time. It was an amazing idea. And then, of course, like a couple of months into it, I realized that I need to focus more. And then the original founder team of Points broke apart after a couple of months. And I think looking back, it was a critical moment because with a high probability, it could have just stopped at a certain point. And then Robert Blum, which is still the CEO and founder of Points, he remained. And I was there too. And then I actually offered him, said, like, listen, we could build that together in one way or another. Mm-hmm. But I need some shares from the founders that left, and we could do that together. And then he agreed. And then we just started to build it with one other guy called Gabriel. He was also still there. And then it was like a couple of people trying to make that still happen. Yeah, this is how it all started.
Amazing. And these 6 years, I'm sure they were intense, you know, with the regular up and down of the startup roller coaster. Would you say that the Points journey was a difficult one that even then might have inspired you to start APSI afterwards?
It definitely was a difficult one. And it definitely played a huge role in starting APSI afterwards, but not out of the obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. The difficult part was, I think Points really was for me to start at university. I went through everything from bootstrapping in the first 1.5 years, unable to pay salaries, almost going bankrupt, almost selling the company at a certain point, losing like the exit in the last minute, really. Oh, man. Then getting funded by Dario and the whole Dine Deal mafia crew. and then scaling the company from like 5-6 people to 40 in 1.5 years. Then revenue-wise, from a couple of $100,000 to a couple of million. So like the whole thing that you would want to do in a startup, I think I experienced in about 6.5 years. Mm-hmm. And then in the end, even met my wife there. So that was a really impactful 6 years. And in the end, yeah, also the kickstart then, of course, of APSI.
I mean, what you just described, right? That's like the highest of the high, like potential exit, potential buyer, acquiring your company, and the lowest lows, probably not being able to pay salary, almost going bankrupt. How do you deal with that? I mean, that takes a toll on you, right? Mm. Especially mentally as a founder, to go through these volatile up and down situations.
Yeah, it's very interesting to look back, because now actually at APSI with a different setup and a different topic, it feels different again. Mm-hmm. To what I felt at Points. And maybe it was an advantage that I was younger and more naive and in a different life situation. And I think I approached things much more with a beginner's mind. I just ran into it and rolled with it. I had nothing to lose in a way. Mm-hmm. And I think that helped me a lot to kind of go through these ups and downs. I had a different position. Ruby is and was the CEO. I was the COO and head of sales. So I built the whole sales engine. And that also has a different kind of role play that goes on, right? Mm-hmm. And for me, it felt very intense, up and down, like an amazing journey, but less of that toll that it could take on you that I feel maybe now a different topic that we work on. Yeah.
Okay, got it. So the age helped to deal with all of that.
I think so, yes. I think having this naive beginner's mind, that helps a lot. Yes.
And nevertheless, you then decided to start the next company. So that is also a good sign.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2019, you then decided to leave Points. Why was that the right decision for you?
I think there are two aspects to it. One was the inspiration and the urge to do APSI or something in the mental health space. It wasn't clear that it was called APSI at the time or is what it is today. The other thing was that also the whole setup of Points for me has come to an end in a way. My co-founder and I, we had different perspectives on where the company should go. Mm-hmm. I felt that I would take in a different direction, in a different role as well. And the opinions, of course, went apart. And then together with that inspiration that I had for APSI, it was the right moment to kind of discuss it and go. And that went really well then as well. So there was no big boom or so. We were able to kind of part path after 6.5 years in a good way.
Can you talk a bit more about these different perspectives, not to go about the details of the strategic decision, but how you had these conversations? Because I feel many co-founders might arrive at the similar point at one point of their entrepreneurial journey, where they say one of the co-founders wants to turn right, the other wants to turn left. How do you do and hold these conversations? Because it sounds like a very difficult one.
Mm. I have the concept or idea that companies are like organisms. So when they start, they're like a little plant or a little human being, and they're raised. And the comparison with a human being is maybe interesting, because the parents have a huge impact on the values and the personality that the kid will have. So the first years are very important. There is never a perfect parenthood, right? What there is an opportunity to at least have conversations about the values. And it was the first time I built something like that. And I think for my co-founder back then as well. And we missed the opportunity in the beginning to have conversations about the values where we think the company should go early on, that we're aligned. I don't know if it would have helped per se, but at least it would have put us closer together. We would have been able to maybe create also language with each other that we know we're talking about and get to know each other. We didn't have that. So I think there were a lot of misunderstandings on the way. And then when the pressure increases and the speed increases, you don't have the time anymore to sync on all of these things. And I think this is what happened. And then in a very simple way, like maybe in a relationship, it has to be something small that suddenly is the reason for you to like move in different directions. But the issue happened already before. And for me, it was like, I think I had more of an idea of changing this, the business model, taking it in a different direction. He was more on profitability. And that was then the fighting ground, but it could have been something else. Yeah.
But then what was like the logical conclusion that one of you had to leave the company? That was quite clear to both of you because you had different perspectives?
I think it was clear for me. I was also then the one coming forward and say, listen, I think it's a binary thing now. It's either this or I'm leaving. And I didn't mean it in a threat way. It was much more like, I think when it comes to me, it should be like this. And otherwise, it's also fair to take the conclusion and leave. And that was a lot of thinking over years, I think, as well. It was a subconscious process that was going on that put me to that point to go like, I think it's this or that. And most probably, I also felt that I want to do my own thing, something with a different purpose, something that is more like me as well, in a way, and be in the driver's seat from day one. I think that was also a reason why I knew it can't go on like this. So.
From the outside, it seems like a very difficult decision, you know, to leave after 6 years. You know, it was also sort of your baby. How did you feel in that moment when you said, hey, it is time to leave for me?
Yeah, that was, I could share a personal detail. Yeah, I don't, maybe not many know it from points as well. So what was nice was we were at a really, really good point. So the team was like, we were like 40 people and we had the best year so far. We had launched a new business model. So we first had these loyalty cards and all these marketing tools. And then we launched the deals, the discounted kind of deals. We had some new things in the making. The team was really up and running. The structure were really good. We had nice hierarchies like built into the company with 40 people. That was really nice. And I think that was so important for me because the team was so important to me. And I felt that we had the right crew that could keep on going. And this gave me a really, really good feeling. I think this is why it made it much easier. What's interesting is that for me was, it felt like very clear and rational. As soon as it was over, I was incredibly emotional. So I remember that was maybe the day after I left and I just went into the office to pack my things and I just started crying, you know. And that's something that not many people know, but it's just, I think it was, I held it back for such a long time because I felt responsible and then it kind of broke out. And that was interesting for me to see because I didn't expect it actually to happen.
But I think that's also very normal because you're processing so many things at the same time and a big part of your life just broke off, right?
Yes. And the emotions that, I mean, as founders, and I'm somehow sure that many of our fellow colleagues would share that opinion. That sometimes, especially when you're young and you do it for the first time, when unpleasant emotions appear, you suppress them because you feel like you can't share this emotion. You can't show any weakness, you know. Yeah. So you suppress it, you push it down for a while. And it changes you, it changes your personality, your appearance. And then it's also good when you find a place to let it go.
I always feel that when you suppress these emotions and you push them down, they just come back stronger a bit later.
Yes, I think I would agree now. Back in when I was 25, 26, so at the beginning of it all, I don't know if I would know what you mean when you said it now. Yeah. Now, after all of these experiences, I would say yes. Yeah. Yes, a lot. And the most difficult ones are fear that you push down, or sadness. And they are coming back in one way or another.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So you left the house in good order, you know, as you say, to bring back the athlete connection. You want to stop it when it's nice, when you have some success. However, there's also some technicalities involved, right? You were a co-founder. You had shares of the company. How did you resolve that? I mean, you worked for it for 6 years, but at the same time, you also want to make sure that the company can continue to succeed, that there might be someone else taking your role and they might need some share as well, you know, to be incentivized. How did you solve that part of you as a co-founder leaving from a business or shareholding perspective?
What helped was that my shares were fully vested. So there was no discussion anymore on like how many shares would be gone if I leave. That made it easy. There were some ESOP left, some more options for employees to be handed out. So for the people taking over, there was a possibility, an instrument to kind of do these things. Okay. It was a rather mature, mature startup, let's call it mature startup. So there were also possibility in other ways to kind of increase maybe the salaries or do other things that would keep the people in the team. That made it easy for me to kind of handle this whole legal part. And then there was also no need for me to kind of, you know, I didn't want to cash out or something like that. I just kept the shares and I felt that's right. Mm-hmm. If there is a moment in time where where you're able to sell it, that's cool. But I think it was also a fair move to do it like that. What was surprising to me, and maybe a learning if it's interesting for others to hear, was that I left rather fast. I didn't know how to handle it, but the board back then, experienced people, they had no issues with it, actually. They said, that's cool, makes sense. We like the clarity of how it should be done and that it's handled well and it's in a good position, but let's do it as fast as possible. So you're not sticking around for the next 6 months. So it was, I think, 2.5 months afterwards I was gone. And that was of course, rather fast, but it helped. And that's maybe also an advice. Don't try to stick around when you split apart. Yeah,
I agree, because it's difficult if you know you're leaving, or also your team knows you're leaving, and then you're there for like another half a year. It just feels weird.
It's maybe like in a relationship when you split up and then you would still live together. I mean, some people manage really well, but
of course,
I think it might be really difficult as well, because there always is some things that you agree or disagree with.
Exactly.
And when you're still around, it's a bit special. Yeah.
So then after you left Points, there was no big break of years or something. You directly jump into the next venture. You then co-founded Apsy in 2020. So quite fast after. Can you talk a bit more about how you met your co-founders and how you started to talk, you know, what would eventually lead to founding a new company?
So maybe I flip the question and say more like where the idea comes from and then how it happened with the co-founders.
Of course.
Because the idea came like a bit earlier. There was summer 2019. And this whole topic of mental health was somehow I saw it popping up here and there, but I didn't really think about it. And then someone that's really close to me went through a difficult time. And I think what's important is that I would have never considered her sick or mentally ill. And that's important for the story, because it was just like I saw that there is like the inner world and the outer world wasn't in a balance. And because I'm an entrepreneur and my general pattern is activity, you try to act. You try to, okay, let's do something, right? So the idea was I just find a psychologist, and I thought it's the most normal thing. So I sat down on my balcony. It was summer. It was hot. And I tried to look for a psychologist on my laptop. And 4 hours later, I was more confused than afterwards. It was so difficult. And there were search platforms and it existed in a way. But the need of me, for me as a client, wasn't fulfilled at all. Right. It was difficult. It was all organized in mental health disorders and issues. So as an example, you need to choose like anxiety disorder. And when you search for someone else, you go like, why would I, I don't know, you know, why would I choose this, right? And then it was organized as if I would, I don't know, buy a book. So there was no chance for me to get a sense if that person matches in a way of personality or so. That was frustrating. And then I ordered food because I was hungry. And I ordered via Uber Eats. And I remember how the bicycle avatar on my app was cycling towards my home in 10 minutes. And I eat these dumplings afterwards. And I go, how is it possible that our society is pouring millions and millions into apps that bring us the food a bit faster and a bit better? Well, when it comes to our mind, which is central to everything we do, yeah, we organize it like this. This can't be. Yeah. And that was like a first principle moment. When you see something, you go like, they can't be the case. And from that moment onwards, I couldn't stop thinking about it. And then when I left, actually, it was really when I left, I approached my first co-founder, Donis. And he's actually a childhood friend of Dani that I did Chebu with. Mm-hmm. And we tried to get him as a CTO for Chebu 10 years before or 8 years before. Yeah. And he declined. Then he did the Points website. And then after that, like in the third trial, he joined actually.
You slowly lured him in.
Yeah, exactly. Took time. And I remember there was it was a commencement speech of Steve Jobs that I watched, and I think everyone did. And he says, you can only connect the dots looking backwards. And sometimes I had that feeling that when I looked back, I see, oh, yes, I met him here and there. And when it matched, it matched. But everything needed to happen for him to join. And the second thing with the second co-founder, he was the lead software engineer at Points. And then he left as well right after me and went to work for a fintech company. And when we needed support early in the early days with tech, we approached him and he was on fire about it. Mm-hmm. So then we asked, you want to join? And then he was like, yes. And then he joined as a third co-founder.
Amazing. And you touched up on this topic a little bit, but one third of the adult population actually suffers from mental health issues and two thirds of them don't seek any help. Mm-hmm. Why is it that we here in Switzerland, especially, don't talk about mental health? Why does that seem to be such a taboo topic?
Hmm. It's something I think about a lot for a while. And of course, I'm an entrepreneur and I have an opinion, right? Because it's a very complex topic and there are people out there with different opinions. Mm-hmm. For me right now, I think it has to do that in the West, at least like in our like cultural spectrum, the outside, the material part of the world is very important. And culturally, nowadays, we orient ourselves on the outside, how we appear, but also what we do, what we act out. Everything that is within and passive. So in philosophical terms, like the sun and the moon, right? The light and the shadow. Yeah. So the other side of everything, the inner world, it's invisible, feels more chaotic and uncontrollable. Mm-hmm. And I think because we like control, we struggle with that inner side and you don't want to look at it. And we talked about suppressing emotions before. So if you run through your life like suppressing this inner side for a while, I think it's fear to look within and you don't want to see potentially what it is. It's not like visible, it's not clear. And then you have a couple of reactions when you're afraid, right? So you run away, you act dead, or you fight. And I think this is then maybe what happens, running away, fighting it away, or just act like it's not there. And I think that's not potentially the right way to deal with these things, yes.
It just seems to be a very bad long-term decision, right? Because you say, oh, I look away now, short-term, but in the long run, you will run into even bigger problems. It's the same as suppressing the emotions and the feelings. And, you know, if you do that for just long enough, you will just build up a bigger and bigger mountain to fight or to climb.
Yeah, and there is, it's not the right term, but it's like an adverse selection issue wish in a way that if it happens and it is really difficult and complex, and the others that have not yet done it look at the person that is in a very difficult and complex situation. They go, uh-oh, this is what happens when you look inside.
Yeah.
And it's actually a confirmation bias. Like it's not this. Like if you would act earlier, it wouldn't be that complex and challenging potentially. Like, we of course need to have a differentiated discussion about what we talk, right? And there's some mental health disorders clearly that have more genetic presets and are more difficult to kind of deal with. But when we talk about more the emotional side, emotional health part, like mild depressions and these kind of things and anxieties, when we talk about this, if you act earlier, it's much easier. And I don't know how you feel about it, you know, because like I'm in a bubble now, because for me, everything seems so clear. And, you know, as a mental health startup, say, like, how is it for you? Like, did you, like, when you hear that, you go like, yeah, I agree, I see that. Or is it like, no, far away, I don't know what he's talking about.
No, 100%. Like, for me, it's very similar, you know, it's like, you need to invest time to pause, to reflect and to see how am I feeling? Do I have things that I suppress, things that I should look at but don't look at because it's uncomfortable, it's scary, it's hard. And there I work with also with a psychologist on a regular basis just to, you know, do check-ins. And if there are topics coming up, we have more sessions, sometimes multiple times a week, to sort things out and to really have a sparring partner on my side to work on these things.
How do you find it? Like, what was the way to get it? Because the whole, when you asked before, why are people not acting? I started to talk about this whole inner side, outside. That's a bit the stigma part, right? Mm-hmm. But there's also the issue of access and cost. Like, these two things are, like, it's the three things, like stigma, access, and cost. Yeah. Access is one issue as well. Like, how do you get started?
Sure.
Many people don't know. And it's also part of cost because you spend a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And I once thought of it that if the pain increases, the suffering level increases, your opportunity costs are extremely high to not act, right? So then it needs to increase. And then you go, now I spend any time, any money, because I need to get this away, right? Yeah. Before, like, where do I find it? If it's difficult, you stop. Like, how was it for you? Was it easy to find?
It was funny. I watched a video. There was this Formula One series on Netflix. So I watched this one and I liked the Mercedes team. And they're the team, I don't know how they call it, team principal. He's Austrian, Toto Wolff. He sort of, I saw a video with him and he said, the mental part is so important. I regularly talk to a psychologist because it helps me to bring the best performance. And that really got my attention. And there, right then, that sort of triggered, hey, I do have things that are on my plate that I didn't take care of. So I also want to go and look for help.
Nice.
That was sort of the trigger for me. And then, you know, he said he talks to psychologists multiple times a month. And then I said, oh, cool. And so I started to then do the research where he mentioned some sources and off I went.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's a pattern that I also witness with my friends, male friends, actually, generally more. If I talk about performance, it's easier for them to find an entrance, right? They go like, oh, of course, it would be about performance. I would do it as well. But like, it's so true, because if you go through life, you will suffer.
Sure.
There's 100% of people suffering in life, right? And at one point or another, you don't know any further yourself. And then it helps a lot to kind of get support, to just learn how to deal with the ups and downs. It doesn't make you just amazing all the time. It's the ups and downs, right? And then you can definitely also talk about performance or think about how could I be better in my job as a leader, as a father, as a mother, as a friend, whatever it is. Yeah. But like, how could I maybe deal with my challenges, emotions, thoughts better to kind of sail the ups and downs much better in life?
It's funny because the performance part lured me in the first place. So that's what triggered it. Oh, I want to, of course, you know, I want performance. But then while talking to the psychologist, we never talked about performance.
Of course.
That was cool, right? It was like the thing that got my attention, but then it was actually in you know, doing the sessions, it was never ever a topic.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I, of course, that was about a year after we founded EPSI. I was like, hey, I'm the founder of that company and I wasn't in therapy so far. No. There must be a way. And I had some challenges that I knew I need to look at. So it's like, let's do that. And it opened up an opportunity. It was another entrepreneur, an investor of EPSI actually, that visits a therapist, psychoanalytical school, once every week for 7 years already. And he was like, listen, great guy. Go and see him if you want to, right? So I check his profile and I see that I'm the founder of EPSI, right? So it's the same thing. But I look at it and go like, therapist, psychologist, and management coach. And it helped me to do the first step even, to go like, yeah, but maybe it's also just about the company, you know?
Yeah.
And then it's a big, big mix. I think the first like 6 months, we never talked about the business. Yeah. It was really just diving within, going back, and it helped so much.
And it makes a ton of sense if you think about that, right? I think first, you need to be good with yourself before you can actually do a good job or eventually even lead other people. You have to do your homework and get your own house in order.
Yeah, right? that's so true. Okay. And I felt that the biggest things that I'm learning right now and maybe also the mistakes that I did in the past as in the leadership role was connected to the image that I had of me or the things that I didn't see, where I was not listening to people enough when I, and it made it, I guess, more difficult for people to work with me. In the leadership team, or when you're an employee of the company that I helped build, and all of these things that I'm doing now, reflecting and talking to, makes me a better person. But then, of course, makes me hopefully also a better person in the role of CEO or whatever it might be.
Exactly. Before you mentioned the 3 points, right? You mentioned stigma, access, but also price. So I wonder, how does APSI play into improving some or all 3 of them?
Yes. So actually, APSI is attacking all 3 of them. What we came up with is we said, what is it? First principle thinking, what is it that we could do that has the highest impact, highest positive impact on the people and the healthcare system? Is there one strategy that we could go that would attack it all? And one way we thought of it is, if you act early, it's always better than late.
Of course.
If you match with a person that you really, really trust and that is really suitable for your need, it's always better than having the opposite.
That's key, because otherwise you do it once and you stop.
It doesn't work. And then it's very interesting as well, if you read research, you see that therapy or talking to a psychologist is considered the most effective intervention. Among other things, one of the most effective intervention when it comes to mental health issues. And the main reason why it works is the relationship between you and the psychologist or therapist. If this is not around, it doesn't work.
Of course.
So we go, okay, if you find early enough a psychologist or therapist that matches you, you don't need so many sessions. You can do it within 7, 8, maybe 10.
Yeah.
And if you have a lot of good psychologists, you also have a variety in skills and price. And we could find a way to help people to get access early. So what you find now on APSI is you Google it, or you find it through your employer or insurance, and you answer 5 questions. Then the algorithm uses the data that we have to show you 3 psychologists we think might match. You listen to their voices. You compare them, you get to know them for free. You can get to know them all for free. That's 15, 20 minutes. And then you can match with them and do the sessions online. If they have a practice location, you can also see them in person.
Sure.
You do the whole payment and the whole receipts and all the sessions, everything through the platform. So you actually don't have to do the whole hustle of like finding someone, going into their waiting room and like getting the bill at home. And it's all very neat, and you pay with Twint or credit cards, you know. It's something that is really down to earth. So it's stigma free. You can access it anytime. You don't need to like tell us that you're sick or whatever it might be. The access is super easy. 5 clicks, I guess, you have it. And then cost, it's shorter. It's effective because it's the right person. And you can also do a 30-minute session with a younger psychologist and you pay $50, right? So there are also your possibilities to kind of navigate your way around. And this is how APSI is helping the individual. But of course, we can also talk about the healthcare system, because that's an interesting part in itself.
We will get there in a second. I wonder about the pricing you mentioned. How do you actually determine the pricing? You know, the price per minute, per hour, whatever it is, how do you come up with that? Is that set by you as a platform, or is that set by the psychologist?
It's set by the psychologist. And that was a very important part. Of course, we discussed it, because usually when you look at business models like Uber, that you, as a client, it appears that it's just a fixed price, right?
Right.
And that's an advantage, makes it easier. On the other side, psychologists and therapists are highly skilled people.
Yeah.
And they deserve the price that they consider correct for them. And we figured that if you do that, it's not that it's just rising to the sky and you only pay a crazy amount of money. Mm-hmm. They're all different kinds of psychologists with different circumstances, different setup. Some people work online, maybe part from another country. Yeah. They have different ways to maybe price it. So it could become more cheap. And then you have very experienced people with a practice location in Switzerland. It might be a bit more expensive and you can choose it yourself. So mm-hmm. it gives the therapist and psychologist a lot of freedom and flexibility. And on the other side, we help the client to choose what he or she needs.
Access is one key part that you make easier. At the same time, you mentioned adverse selection before. I imagine that could also apply here, right? Mm. The most famous, well-known, best-skilled psychologist, they might always be fully booked. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to go to them, right? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe people who are not as skilled or don't have this experience yet are less booked. So how do you make sure that you get good quality psychologists on the platform, because they probably have already more than enough clients?
Mm. It's a very, really good question. So first, I think it might be a result of the media structure that we have, that there is an idea that there are these superstar therapists that you go to and they tell you, Nicholas, you should do this. And then you do it and life is great.
Like a guru.
A guru, yes. I think we tend to like these ideas. And then it's also nice to see that this is not how therapy or psychology works. Yeah. And the empathy and the possibility to build a relationship, it's much more important. And that's not unique to just one or two people. Mm-hmm. I think psychologists and therapists per se, because they also choose that profession, tend to have this skill set. What we do is we have a tailor-made onboarding process. So, of course, we check all the professional backgrounds and certificates and diplomas. Yeah. Strafregister, also like certificate, like these kind of things, basic things. And then we have the possibility, because we are a platform that transact everything from the first match to the last session, to get, for example, also feedback from clients, quantitative and qualitative, mm-hmm. and work it back into the matching algorithm or into the selection process of the psychologist. So we have a possibility over time to refine that matching and make it stronger and stronger, which helps then you, if you would go onto our platform, to find someone with your preset that matches you with a higher probability than when you look for it otherwise. Yeah.
So basically your pitch is a bit like, hey, the tech part that you have has huge advantages in terms of efficiency, but especially matching quality for both psychologists and users, patients, to not waste their time.
Yes. Yes, it's definitely less of a waste of time because you have less sessions. It is because you have the selection, also the possibility to opt in for the thing that you want. Mm-hmm. It's not like you have one price defined by the state and no one really knows if this is the right or not. But maybe if you're a student, you have a smaller budget, you choose the therapist X. And yeah. if you are a 45-year-old that maybe is in a high management position and you're looking for a therapist Y, you can choose it as well. The choice of the free market is helping as well to make the system more effective. And the last part is for insurance companies too, right? They're of course, at a certain point, interested to know if I'm paying for it, I want to make sure it's effective. And of course, EPSI can prove that with much higher certainty if you have the information. Yeah.
And let's talk about that, the current health market or Medicare, if I can call it that way. At the moment, it seems that our whole medical system is set up to, hey, I have something, give me a pill, fix me. Mm. So it's way more reactive than proactive, right? So what role does the preventative part take, you know, play in today's Medicare?
I think it's a bit what preventative healthcare, mental healthcare in our case, is maybe a bit what Tesla is to the fuel-driven cars or Airbnb to the hotels. Because it is so obvious that this is what needs to happen. Like obvious in a way that it doesn't matter who you talk to. Could be, I just had a conversation with the CEO of an insurance, very inspiring guy. He says it as well, you know. And then you talk to psychologists and therapists and they say, like everyone says, if you act earlier, If you invest in prevention, it's the right thing to do. Yeah. The question is, why doesn't it happen?
Right.
And I think it's an issue of incentives right now in the system. Mm-hmm. So how the economy is built, like the healthcare economy is built, is also a bit of a legacy of the past. Much more this orientation towards sickness. This is why it's called sick care and Krankenkasse, right? It's a kasse for the sick.
Right.
And this is something that is shifting slowly. The machine is a very big machine, mm-hmm. and this needs to shift. And like in a simple way, how I imagine it could work is that if you would start to invest and put incentives also that insurance companies would be able to like change the business models in a way that they are able to pay for these preventive healthcare things, mm-hmm. I think you would see more and more innovation in that field, and clients have the choice to opt out of maybe what they get through the base insurance, mm-hmm. And choose their own way. Yes, I think this would be interesting. And we hear it sometimes that we're more in this private market. We're working with Zusatzversicherungen, so with private insurances. And they say, yeah, but what if you can't afford it? And the interesting part, I think, is if you imagine you're like lining up for in front of a point of sale, right? And they would maybe sell painkiller drugs at a discounted price, symbolizing the base insurance. They only have a limited amount of pills. What happens is after a while, they're like, kilometers of people lining up in front of that one point of sale.
Yeah.
And then politicians and insurance companies and the public starts to discuss there are not enough pills. We need to reduce the price. We need to make the pills smaller so we can hand out more. And we say, yeah, what if you have 20 point of sale next to it that offer different services with different colors? So for example, you would have one for couple therapy, you would have one for individual therapy online that is maybe covered through the private insurance. What would happen is that this long queue would split across the other 10 point of sale, also for the people that can afford it, while the line in front of point of sale number one becomes smaller. So the people that can't afford the other get access faster. Yeah. This is what would be very interesting to build.
And at the same time, it's not happening yet, or not at the speed it should be happening. Mm. Healthcare costs are going through the roof. We always read about that in the newspaper that, you know, insurance premiums will be going up and up and up. So what needs to happen? Is it on the political level? Is it on the business level? Is it on an incentive level, or all of them combined to really change the system and switch from reactive to preventative Medicare?
I definitely think it's a combination of many things, but it could be summarized in what you said, incentives. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think this is the simplest answer, because right now you have the challenge. It's interesting to think about it. The base insurance in Switzerland is not allowed to make profits. That's a smart system in a way. Mm-hmm. And it is run by private insurances, which has the advantage that they think more entrepreneurial than if the state would potentially do it.
Because you're in competition.
You're in competition with each other. So that's actually a smart system. Mm-hmm. Now, the challenge with this is that when something like psychotherapy is in the base insurance, there is no incentive anymore for the private insurances to cover anything else, because they just push every cost into this base insurance, because they're not allowed to make costs. And if the cost is too high, they raise prices because it's done via the public.
Yeah.
Now, what happens is, for example, that they now request a diagnosis because they want to get a gatekeeper that not everyone gets this. In this example before, the discounted pill, right?
Of course.
Now, suddenly young people must have a diagnosis to get access to a therapist through the base insurance. So what happens is that now everyone needs to have a depression before they actually get money through the base insurance, which is an interesting incentive. It shouldn't be like that.
No, of course.
So it should be much more that the private insurances maybe support healthcare, preventive healthcare. I know that there are things going on in that direction, but also there, imagine you have a product like a private insurance. You sell this through your channels. Let's say it costs $300 a year. And then you actually don't want your customer to use your product, because if you actually use your private insurance, it's Zusatzversicherung, then they need to pay more. So it is set up in a way that only a certain amount of people should get support in a certain year. So it's an interesting structure where you ask yourself, is it even possible? What if we break it up and allow new models, like more service-based models, where you maybe pay a fixed membership fee and get really nice support from healthcare companies? That would be an interesting system, more privatized, more free. And I think everyone needs to work together to make this happen.
It feels like there's a big pile of money coming in every year, you know, through everyone that has the insurance, the health insurance. And then the insurance company protects that with gatekeepers to ensure that that pile of money is enough to pay for whatever claim comes out of it. And to shift that, to say, I actually give you more money without having a gatekeeper to invest in preventative healthcare, that seems to be an incredibly risky bet for them because they are scared that this pile of money might not be enough.
Yes,
and it pays dividends, so to speak, years down the road. So it's, from their perspective, probably a very risky investment.
Yes, it is. And the interesting thing is to also, like, I don't want to protect the insurances, but that's actually the job that they got from the government to say, you need to keep costs under control in the base insurance. So you need to build these gatekeepers because otherwise it gets out of hand.
Yeah.
So they do that. Yeah. On the other side, I know that some insurance would like to be more in what you just described, but then it's also a political process.
Yeah.
How do you create that? Because there's always this label of you just want to make money with people that are unwell. So to sum it up, I think there is a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm. I see good things on the horizon, but it needs to be openly discussed. Things need to change. We have some politicians that also see that. Mm-hmm. We have someone among our ranks, for example, André Silberschmidt, that is in the startup community, also really well connected, that is also having very interesting ideas, one example, to make the healthcare system more effective. Yeah.
There's one last part that I want to talk about, and that's your business model. How does APSI actually make money?
Mm. Yes, so there is an interesting aspect when we think about startups and entrepreneurship, because I read once about this and it had an impact on how we decided at APSI how we want to design the business model. It was that the pricing, especially in the early days, the business model needs to be aligned with your mission. That makes it very easy. Because if you have an incentive for yourself with the pricing, the business model, that goes away from your mission, you find yourself down the road at a different place you don't want to be. So for us, it was really important that you find early the right match. So a good psychologist and a good match. So we need to make sure that the people that book with us stay for a certain while. And the best business model for us is take a percentage per session. Yeah. Because this gives us the opportunity to optimize for quality and not for quantity in terms of more and more psychologists and more clients. Mm-hmm. And this is the right thing for us. And it has proven itself that it was a rather good decision to do that.
I imagine then a subscription-based model will probably go against your mission because then you keep people longer in the sessions than probably necessary.
Yeah, it's very interesting because maybe you have also, when you were looking for a psychologist yourself, you've maybe checked other platforms and there are forms of it. And one is, I saw it, I think in the US, that you pay a fixed amount per week.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have like chat messages open. What's interesting with this is you force the psychologist and the client into a model because you like it as a company.
Yeah.
I found that weird because you should actually give the client the freedom and the psychologist the freedom to decide what they want. So in the future, I don't know which business model would support maybe the mission 2 years down the road. Like there may be possibilities for other business models. But right now, this is the best for us to focus on our mission.
I have two follow-up questions on that part. Is that also, you know, if you cannot go into the subscription part just yet, is that also sort of a limiting factor for you from a business perspective? Because I know investors love recurring revenue, et cetera.
Yeah.
So is that something that you feel limits your valuation or your business potential to a certain degree?
I don't think so in the mid and long run.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting to witness this because in the beginning, when I went out looking for investors and I said, we go B2C first, I heard exactly what you just said. They go like, what? Switzerland B2C.
Yeah.
But it forces you to think deeply about what you want and where you want to go. Mm-hmm. And then we said B2C first, And maybe in a second step, we go B2B because we offered maybe the same thing for employers too at a certain point, right? We now have nice partnerships also lined up. And then 1 or 2 years down the road, you somehow make it happen. You find investors that believe in the mission. Andreessen Horowitz from the US, the venture capital fund, comes forward and says, there is a new way for healthcare businesses to start. Mm-hmm. It's B2C to B. You go B2C first to build traction, and then you take a B2B, like Headspace, for example, right? Yeah. They went B2C first and then B2B. Yeah. So in the end, sometimes VCs, investors, universities, they lag behind the market. Mm-hmm. The entrepreneur is the one that is doing the innovation. And you need to think of what makes most sense for your clients. You come up with new ideas. And then afterwards, everyone goes, oh, it's B2C to B, you know.
Of course.
And then in 5 years, maybe there's some...
oh, it all makes sense.
Exactly. Yeah. And they go, we only invest in B2C to B now.
Oh, of course.
So I think it's important that you try to stick to your mission and your clients. Yeah.
However, with Headspace, they are also B2C, a subscription-based model. I think that's a difference. Yeah. But I mean, B2B, I think that could be a really, really interesting market for you to tap into.
Yes, and it's definitely something we go towards. Yeah. But quickly on the membership one, if you think first principle, I go, what is membership? What is the interesting thing for an investor? It's plannable revenue, right? They want to see like, okay, I can predict that next year this happens.
Yeah.
If you look at mental health, and if you see a psychologist, it's rarely the case that you see him just once, right? So there is a certain predictability at a certain point, and there is a certain returning revenue as well. And over time, you learn, of course, that people have more like always some kind of challenges they might want to reflect. Yeah. So then you go, okay, actually, first principle wise, it makes sense. There is a certain planability, but we just call it different. Why would we force someone into the business model that we don't want? So that's for the membership part.
Yeah. It's a bit like the razor blades, for example. Mm. You don't have a subscription, but you always need a new razor blade, right?
So that's interesting. And the innovation with, what was the name? $1 Shave Club.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. He made it. So I think there's always kind of a moment when innovation is coming in.
Yeah.
Because Headspace was also an innovation with Calm. No one was paying upfront the yearly fee for a mental health app.
Yeah.
If you would have pitched that, people would go, impossible.
No one
does that.
Yeah.
And then they do it and suddenly it's common sense.
Yeah.
Yes.
Let's also talk about the market size. Is Switzerland a big enough market for you?
I think so, yes. And also there, you know, it's... I remember listening to a podcast once about Airbnb when they were trying to raise money in the early days. How big is the rental home market?
Yeah,
you know,
of course.
That's difficult to quantify. But if you look at how many people are booking trips and holidays and hotels, you go, actually, that's a similar thing.
Right.
If you look at look at the market in the same way, you see that first you have many people that go to therapists. You have many people, like we're in the billions in Switzerland already.
Which is crazy for the size of the market, if you think about it, right?
Yes, it is. It is. And then it is not when you look at the level of pain that you can solve with it. Because in economics, it's like, what are you willing to pay for? What's the service that you're getting? And what's the price for solving the issue with your wife? You know, it's there is no on it, you know.
Yeah.
So I think when you have the pain at a certain point, you're willing to kind of invest to reduce that in a way. And then you have substitutes, you know, alcohol, for example. If you think from a different angle, many people drink because they suffer, you know, and like how much suffering is out there. And then they don't pay sessions right now, you know.
Of course.
But what if they would find a way through insurance or whatever earlier to talk to someone that would help them to not get into that place? That would be beautiful. So I think there is a lot of human potential. There's a lot of potential to lower suffering. And then in Swiss franc terms, there will be definitely also enough around, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we heard a lot about, you know, where you come from and what APSI does. I think it's a very great mission that you follow, and we certainly need that in Switzerland.
Thank you.
At the same time, we're also very curious, what have you planned for the future?
With APSI?
Yeah.
I think it was a job interview. Someone asked, like, when is it enough? when do you stop? And that's a question entrepreneurs, I think startup entrepreneurs here, maybe here and there. When do you stop? And I thought about that question, and then I read about an interview from Vivienne Westwood, the fashion icon. And I think she said, a piece of cloth has made it if it's part of the culture. Mm-hmm. And I liked that idea. I was like, what if the preventative mental health care is part of culture? And our kids and kids of kids, they don't even ask anymore. They just look back and they go like, what did you do when you, like, you just waited, you know, you just suppressed it, but you knew it was. So it's like so obvious that you go like, how could you even not do it, right? I think that would be a nice place to go to if EPSI could just push that forward, if EPSI could be one driving force in that area, in Switzerland or other countries. That would be amazing to have. That's the way to go, because I see a lot of happy people then and a lot of people that live happier lives than today. I think that's where we should go. In business terms, there's a lot of potential still on the B2C side, of course. We have different parts of the country that we launched that we can be stronger in. We definitely see more potential on the employer side because employers have an interest that people are, of course, healthy and happy. And on the insurance side as well, I think there's a lot of potential. All the things we discussed before, that insurance double down on this thing to put preventative healthcare, mental healthcare forward.
I love that. Even if you just take 2-3 steps more towards that direction that you just described, that's already a big progress.
Then we're already really happy already.
Exactly. That's true. So to wrap up the episode, we also have some rapid fire questions for you. I give you a short question and you have to answer ideally in one sentence.
That's difficult for me.
Let's see. You ready?
Yeah.
Let's go. If you could send a message across time to the Nicholas who had not yet been to therapy, what message would he send? Maybe also an emoji or a GIF.
Okay. It's like, talk less, listen better and more to yourself.
Nice. And how do you wind down at the end of a difficult day?
Sport helps, run in the forest and a good conversation with my wife.
Nice. And how has talking to a psychologist changed you? It's probably difficult to put that into words.
Ask the people around me. That's maybe easier. Yeah.
Okay. But it sounds like a very, very positive impact.
Yes, it was. I think I found language for like the inner world. Yeah.
And why are people so afraid of psychological support?
Potentially misinformation and a bit of fear. Mm-hmm.
There's one quote that came to mind when you were talking about everything, and it's from Naval Ravikant, and he said, hard choices, easy life, easy choices, hard life. And I think that's so deep, and I think to anyone thinking about, should I try, like talking to a psychologist or therapy, should I try to do that? Just give it a try. Maybe it's the hard choice today, but hopefully it leads to the easy life afterwards.
That's so true. And maybe EPSI makes the hard choice a bit easier.
Exactly. Absolutely. Nicholas, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Lots
so
of
much.
Success and all the best for the future.
Thank you so much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, you can support us by rating our show on Apple Podcasts. This way, we can reach an ever-growing number of aspiring entrepreneurs.